Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Vice President Dick Cheney is in Turkey today on the last leg of his run through the Middle East. By all reports, the vice president has been seeking support for a military campaign in Iraq to overthrow Saddam Hussein. So far, Arab leaders have responded with a resounding no. No support, no resources, no blessing for war on Iraq. But is the U.S. prepared to forge ahead anyway? This hour, inside the Middle East's halls of power, we look at Cheney's talks, Arab resistance, and what's at stake in the prelude to a war. First, news from Afghanistan, where Operation Anaconda has ended, but military operations are expected to go on. Army General Tommy Franks said today that Operation Anaconda was a success, but not the end of the story. More fighting in Afghanistan may affect plans for Iraq. Major Charles Heyman is editor of Jane's World Army. Earlier, I asked him about the Afghan war and the significance of Arab opposition to a U.S. push on Baghdad.
Well, I think really Dick Cheney was doing the rounds. I think the U.S. expected this. And the various ambassadors in all the various places have been warning of this for a long time. But it's one of the things that a senior official from the U.S. administration had to do, to go and see the Arab leaders face-to-face, explain the U.S.'s position, and at least draw some conclusions from that. And if those leaders are not willing to go along with the U.S. and its aims and ambitions vis-a-vis Iraq, then so be it. But it's something that had to be done, and I don't think Dick Cheney was surprised.
Logistically, can the United States push ahead with military action against Iraq, against Saddam Hussein, without the support of the region's Arab nations?
There are all sorts of plans. It is just about possible if you, as Donald Rumsfeld describes it, think outside the box. There's no reason, for instance, why there couldn't be a complete air embargo of Iraq. And there's no reason why U.S. and maybe coalition forces shouldn't go into Iraq a small distance and then cut all the access routes, maybe even take over an Iraqi airfield and mount their operations against the Baghdad regime from just inside Iraq, maybe moving in from Kuwait in the first instance, because Kuwait looks as though it's on side. So there are all sorts of U.S. options. The U.S. doesn't necessarily need to do things out of Saudi Arabia or Turkey or Jordan or somewhere like that. And remember, the U.S. has the ability to project carrier-borne aircraft from both the Gulf and from the Red Sea. So there are options for the U.S. It would have been much better if the U.S. had the Arab governments on side. But it doesn't necessarily mean the U.S. cannot act, and Saddam Hussein knows that.
Is there anything, then, that Washington does need from the region's Arab nations in an engagement with Iraq?
Well, that's a really difficult one. Washington would have liked the goodwill, but I think the mood in Washington is if we don't get the goodwill and we don't get the basing facilities, at least all we want them to do is stand clear and let us get on with what we're doing in our own way.
And Charles Heyman, how do plans for some kind of operation in Iraq against Saddam Hussein interact with the ongoing military situation in Afghanistan? Are they related?
Yes, they are related, and it's all part of this fascinating chess game of international politics. Now, up to around about 10 days ago, I think those plans for Iraq were being firmed up, and they'd come a long way from the drawing board, and people were thinking about seriously about how it was going to be done, the timetable, what troops were going to be used, how they were going to get them into theater. This was predicated on the assumption that Afghanistan was going smoothly, and basically the U.S. responsibility in Afghanistan would have literally withered on the vine within another 2 to 3 months. Now, what's happened in the last few days in Afghanistan has probably thrown those plans for Iraq into disarray, and people are probably thinking again now and saying, hang on, we have serious problems in Afghanistan, and it looks as though those problems might be bigger than we thought, and we might be bogged down in Afghanistan for some time to come. So people are probably now looking at this very carefully and trying to work out some options, because there is more Taliban in southern and eastern Afghanistan than anyone thought.
We talked to you a couple of weeks ago, Charles Heyman. You were predicting an extended guerrilla war there. Now U.S. papers are reporting the same message out of the Pentagon. But does that mean that the rest of President Bush's war on terror has to wait, or can it roll on in spite of a longer-term entanglement in Afghanistan?
It almost certainly will roll on, but the longer-term entanglement in Afghanistan will almost certainly take the priority out of some other areas like Yemen, Philippines, Somalia, and of course Iraq as well. I mean, the US and the coalition forces, they don't have an unlimited number of troops and an unlimited number of aircraft and the hardware that's necessary for all of these tasks. So everybody is going to have to prioritize. And right at this moment in time, Afghanistan and southern and eastern Afghanistan, that area around the Pakistani border, has to be the priority one. Because if they don't destroy the Taliban in these areas, then the government of Hamid Karzai in Kabul has little chance of surviving in the long term.
What do you make of recent reports that there are groups in the north of Iraq, in Kurdish-controlled areas, that are supplied or supported both by Saddam Hussein and by al-Qaeda? Does this look like a legitimate link between the two in your eyes?
Well, first of all, we've known about the groups in the north being supplied by Saddam Hussein for some considerable time. The al-Qaeda connection runs naturally on from that. Now, we don't know the extent of that al-Qaeda connection, but it's almost certainly there. All we have to do is to really to identify the size of it at some stage. But that's not an impossible thing to do, and that's going to come. But we really do need to see the hard evidence, and the hard evidence of a lot of other allegations against Iraq, before you could really get a credible international coalition together. And we're still waiting for that hard evidence.
And in your view, at this point, is war on Iraq inevitable?
It's an interesting question. I'd have answered it a different way. I would have said almost certainly yes after I left Washington. With what's been happening in the last few days, I think it probably is inevitable, but it's farther away now than it was a week, 10 days ago.
Because of Afghanistan?
Because of Afghanistan, yeah. And I think, I mean, a serious dose of reality is settling in both Washington and London about the extent of the problems in Afghanistan.
Major Charles Heyman is editor of Jane's World Army. He spoke to us from Shrewsbury, England. Some military analysts may see war on Iraq as inevitable, but Vice President Dick Cheney told Turkish officials today that the U.S. has no immediate plans to attack Turkey's southern neighbor. What did Dick Cheney hear behind closed doors in the Middle East? Without the support of the Arab world, is the United States in a position to take on Saddam? Should Washington listen to Arab leaders and let Iraq alone, or saddle up for Baghdad? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us tonight in the studio is Ambassador Edward Walker, Ned Walker. He's president of the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C., and writes a bimonthly column, Letters from Washington, in Al Hayat, the biggest Arabic-language daily newspaper in the Middle East. Ned Walker has held a huge number of top diplomatic posts in the Middle East, including U.S. Ambassador to Israel, U.S. Ambassador to Egypt, U.S. Ambassador to the United Arab Emirates. He was Deputy Chief of Mission in the U.S. Embassy in Saudi Arabia and has also completed diplomatic tours in Syria, Lebanon, and Tunisia. Good evening and welcome, Ned Walker.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for being with us. And with us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is On Point news analyst and senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine, Jack Beattie. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Ned Walker, You, like many of us, must have tracked Dick Cheney's tour with interest. It doesn't seem as though he came out of the Middle East with what he was looking for going in. You must have hosted many of these high-level tours of big Washington officials while you were in the Middle East. You were in the Middle East at the time of the Gulf War, so you know even of Dick Cheney's work at that time in setting the stage for that that conflict with Iraq. Talk to us first at the top level, and then we want to go in country by country. But mm-hmm. what do you think Dick Cheney was looking for? What did he need in this tour? How much of it did he get?
Yeah, well, I mean, the vice president was looking for support for, first of all, the war on terrorism, and second of all, for the potential of an effort to unseat Saddam Hussein. This was no mystery to the countries in the region. They knew what he was coming for. What happened, though, was that in the process of developing this trip, at first that was the focus, but then the situation between the Palestinians and the Israelis became so critical that most of the countries that he visited were mesmerized by that issue and found it very difficult to get off it. They were giving him a clear message that the United States can't ignore that and expect to get cooperation on an invasion of Baghdad.
But, of course, that's not quite the way most of these nations put it in public. All the Arab leaders said, we are concerned about the Israeli-Palestinian situation, especially the circumstances of the Palestinians, and we think invading Iraq is a bad idea. Most of them separated the two.
Well, I don't think they're actually separated in their mind. Most of the leaders in the country have a number of priorities and requirements. First of all, they all despise Saddam Hussein. They would love to see him disappear. Second, they have to be sure that if we take this move that we're going to go through with it and it's going to be successful. Third, they've got to make, in their own minds, they have to come out believing that it's not going to fragment Iraq, that it's not going to be wound up as a Kurdish state, a Sunni state, and a Shiite state.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, they've got to get some sense that we know what we're doing and that we have an idea of what's going to happen afterwards. Now, I don't think anybody doubts the military capability of the United States. The basic question for the military, is it easier or harder, depending on how much support we get in the region and where we can put our troops and how many troops can we bring to bear? But some of the other questions are certainly have not been answered by the administration yet and still need a lot of work.
So when you hear Arab leaders, Middle Eastern leaders coming out one after another and saying no to an attack on Iraq, and just today Prime Minister or Vice President Cheney is hearing that from the Turkish Prime Minister, we understand. What do you hear? The Turkish Prime Minister says the economic impact on Turkey would be unacceptable. We're concerned about turmoil in Iraq that would spill over into Turkey. It doesn't sound as though they're just saying, hold on, help the Palestinians first. What do you hear in the big no's?
In Turkey, the big question mark for them is, what does it do to the southeastern areas of Turkey where they have serious economic problems and which has been dependent on trade with Iraq? Will this totally disrupt all of the trade with Iraq? They're also saying, we do not want to have an independent Kurdish state on our border. We don't want to have the kind of problems this would cause for us and for our populations. They want answers to those questions. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that Cheney's in a position yet to fully answer those concerns. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be in their best interest to say no until they get something a lot more clear.
Mm-hmm. Jack Beattie, it was quite a chorus in total that the vice president heard in the Middle East.
Yeah, it was. And when you look at the dependence of these countries on U.S. Goodwill, it's even more extraordinary. I mean, Jordan, for example, we have trade leverage and we give them $150 million in economic aid this year, yet they said no. Egypt, $650 million in aid this year, yet they said no. We base troops in Saudi Arabia to defend against Saddam, yet they said no. Kuwait owes its existence to the United States. They were cool. Qatar, U.S. base, no. Turkey, they want trade concessions from us, so you'd think they'd be willing to say yes. They say no. You know, this was really, I think, a kind of at once a humiliating failure, this mission, and a chance to change course, to use Major Hyman's terms, to become acquainted with reality. And what's been driving the Iraq policy, I think, within the Bush administration has been a kind of ideology, we must get Saddam. Why? Well, because we must get him, and he poses these threats and so on. But now we've suddenly had an education in the local realities, and I'm hoping that Dick Cheney left as Dick Cheney and returns as Colin Powell.
Well, that seems somehow unlikely, but you provoke us as always, Jeff. We've got a lot to talk about here. We're looking at Dick Cheney's tour of the Middle East. He's been looking for support for U.S. invasion of or military action against Saddam Hussein, anyway, in Iraq. What do you think? Should Washington listen to Arab leaders saying no to an invasion of Iraq? Should the U.S. go after Saddam, whether or not Washington has regional support? Do Arab leaders know something Washington doesn't, or are they just afraid to take on Saddam? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Vice President Dick Cheney's tour of the Middle East, looking support for war against Iraq. Our guest is Ned Walker. He's president of the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C. He writes a monthly column, Letters from Washington, in Al Hayat, the most widely read Arabic language daily newspaper in the Middle East. And he's been U.S. ambassador to Israel, Egypt, and the United Arab Emirates, among many other diplomatic postings in the Middle East. You're welcome to join the conversation as well. If Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Jordan say no to war in Iraq, do you say yes anyway? What should we hear in the resistance from Middle East capitals? What should the U.S. heed, and what should it, what can it ignore? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Ambassador Walker, Charles Heyman said at the top of the hour that in spite of everything, he still sees war on Iraq as inevitable, perhaps a little further out since there's been more resistance in Afghanistan than expected. Jack Beatty's wondering if maybe the tenor of response in the Middle East on Dick Cheney's tour might provoke a rethink in Washington. What do you think in between those two polls?
I don't think there's going to be a rethink. I think the administration is committed, has been from day one. The questions really are how do you do it and how much support you can get, and that depends on the way you're going to do it and what the upshot is going to be. This is not an easy military operation. I mean, it may be if everything turns out right, but you don't plan military operations on that basis.
On ease.
You do it on the basis of the hardest possible scenario, and that is if you have to go in and you pry Saddam Hussein out of Baghdad. That's going to cost lives.
So the military operation won't be easy, and this diplomatic initiative of Dick Cheney's appears not to have been easy either. Jack Beatty sees it as a bust. By your own standards, these capitals are saying no because they didn't get the answers they're waiting to hear from Dick Cheney. Was the vice president ready to answer that the concerns of Arab capitals? And secondly, was this a bust, or is this just the way it goes?
No, look, in the first place, this mission was to consult. I really believe that. This is not phony in this administration. For the very first day, I was in the NSC meetings with the president, with Cheney, with Secretary of State. And they wanted to be a hallmark of this administration that it would consult with its allies and with its friends before it took steps. And so I think this mission was there to do just that, was to consult, find out what the concerns are.
How would you compare it to the similar trips that Cheney made before the Gulf War, both in what he came with and the response that he went away with?
Problem's a lot more complex now. In the Gulf War, you had an actual invasion of an Arab country. You had an Arab coalition where Arab troops, like the Egyptians, were committed side by side with Americans, made it a lot easier for people to support what we were trying to do. Nowadays, you've got a will on the part of people to get rid of this man, but they don't know how. And they're deeply concerned about what the impact will be if it fails, or if it takes a long time, or if there's huge casualty count, or if it leads to a breakup in Iraq. Mm-hmm. They've got popular opinions to deal with as well. Mm-hmm. And those opinions are very hostile to the United States, so long as it appears, as it has for some time now, to be so favoring Israel.
Jack Beatty, Ambassador Walker sees this as a consultative trip with Dick Cheney really listening to Arab potential allies and longtime allies, but not prepared to change course in Washington's planning.
Well, I think they've changed one part of the course, and that is regarding the Israel-Palestine portfolio. I think General Zinni's portfolio now is broader than it was, perhaps even broader than it was before this trip began. One diplomat today was quoted as saying he comes with a much, much better sense of reality, that word again, and that we're not just going to talk about security issues, which the Israelis want to talk about, but also about political issues. issues and the political settlement, which the Palestinians want to talk about. And even Cheney, in a statement from Jerusalem, spoke of a, quote, political process that will end the half century of conflict. So I do think he was listening. And that this is a reaction in part, of course, to the violence, but also to what these governments were telling him.
Mm-hmm. Ambassador Walker, you've sat at exactly the tables Dick Cheney sat at. Take us as ambassador to Israel, to Egypt, to United Arab Emirates. You were in a very high post in Saudi Arabia. Take us into one or a couple of these and describe for us exactly the kind of nub of the meaning that Dick Cheney would have faced in Saudi Arabia, in Jordan. Who is the real bottom line guy he's talking with, and where do you think this conversation really came out? What did it come down to between these two in private?
Yeah, well, the bottom line guy in Saudi Arabia is the Crown Prince Abdullah. Mm-hmm. The Crown Prince is facing enormous problems at home. He has been trying to revise the Saudi approach to its own society, change its educational system, rein in the radical Islamists in Saudi Arabia. And he needs to have a stable base on which to operate. He particularly feels strongly about the Palestinian issue and about the impact on the region and on his own stability.
Is this an intimate conversation? Dick Cheney must know him pretty well.
Is he
saying, look, Dick, I just can't do this until you can tell me A, B, and C, or I'm with you, but I can't say so, you're going to have to push it through on your own?
No, he's not going to say the latter. What he's basically telling Cheney is that, look, if you want to get support from this region and you want to get our leadership in this region, you've got to basically understand that we are constrained. We're constrained by the concerns that our own populations feel, by our own desires for development and so on. And that constraint applies to the Palestinian-Israeli issue, and it also applies to the premises on which you're going into Iraq. What is the justification? How do you see this coming out? How are you going to ensure that we're not going to have a worse situation with Hussein on the throne as opposed to
Saddam Hussein?
The son of Saddam Hussein.
Round two.
By all accounts, is even worse. He needs to have some assurances that we're not going down a blind alley and we won't come out worse with real instability, which affects his own society.
We heard from our military analyst at the top of the hour, Charles Heyman, that despite the headlines out of Kuwait, that even Kuwait said no, that what he saw there was a qualified yes, that they would be prepared to give the U.S. just enough of a foothold to launch the campaign, perhaps then set up bases inside Iraq. Do you see Kuwait giving that sliver of light to the U.S. that it needs as a minimum, we're told, to go into Iraq?
Well, I think Kuwait will be supportive of any U.S. initiative, but it's not just a matter of Kuwait. You've got real problems in securing enough basing for aircraft, for the support structure, the C-130 refuelers, the AWACS aircraft, and so on. These are not based primarily in Kuwait. And while
you're talking Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia is what you're talking about. And the whole logistics pipeline, which includes Oman, includes Qatar, includes the UAE, and so on. Each of these countries in its own way is important. They're part of the footprint that our military has established out there. But part of the justification for this was that each has a role to play in any kind of an operation like this. Cut one out and you can compensate. Cut two or three out and you're beginning to get into serious problems.
It starts to get tough. Ambassador Walker, stand by. We have a lot of people who want to join this conversation. Phil is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Welcome, Phil. You're on the air.
Thank you. Yes, I'd just like to make the point that I think it's important that we realize as American public that what we read in the papers and what these politicians over in the Middle East are saying in public is not necessarily what is being said behind closed doors. And I think the ambassador touched on this point. And as opposed to what Jack B was referring to, this being some sort of humiliating process, in that I wouldn't expect, unless we we had a very, very firm plan, like the ambassador was mentioning, mm-hmm. a firm plan with clear objectives, and this was all laid out to everyone involved, that they're going to come out to their public, and also then to, by extension, to the American public, to their public, and saying, yes, we back up what the Americans are planning to do and overthrow this, evil regime. And then if something goes wrong,
you don't expect to hear them say that, Phil.
No, not at all.
Right.
In fact, I'd be very, very surprised if they said something mm-hmm. like that, given that their population is generally not particularly educated and maybe holds the grievances against the United States for, in their minds, perhaps being anti-Muslim and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Phil, we got your point. Let me put it to Ambassador Walker and to Jack Beatty. Ambassador Walker, assess it in both terms, I guess. First, strictly in diplomatic terms, and you know those very well. Is it considered a success to come away from a trip like this with so many public no's? And secondly, in private terms, do you believe that these really were no's, or are these covers for a more candid conversation that's not as opposed to an invasion of Iraq?
Well, I would say they're no's, but they're conditional no's. They're effectively, look, with what you've given us at this point, we're not ready to join this bandwagon. You need to do more homework. You've got to tell us what in the heck are your plans for the future. And remember, the administration has had very little time to prepare a sequence for the future. In fact, they're talking about a conference now in Europe at some place where they can bring people from opposition together and start to talk. Exactly how would you set up a follow-on government?
Mm-hmm. So give it to us in a diplomatic assessment. Is Dick Cheney kicking trash cans on Air Force Two? Is he reaming out the State Department guys and saying, look, I expected a better response than that. We weren't ready. This isn't the way it's supposed to be. Or is he saying, well, that's just the way it goes?
He's setting the stage. He's doing development work. He is giving these countries not only the impression but the reality of consultation. That's very important in that part of the world. Second of all, he's giving them a heads up as to what is involved, what we're thinking about, how we might go about it, what might be the outcomes, and that we have more work to do. So this is not a failure as far as I can see. It is certainly not nobody's raised their hands and said, yes, we're with you, but the final story hasn't been written yet.
Jack Beatty, in Ambassador Walker's analysis, we hear that Bush administration that sets a course and just keeps churning toward it.
Yes, and I defer to his analysis and understanding of these things. But what struck me as a total amateur was the bluntness of some of these no's. Catastrophe was what the Jordanian king called an invasion. Mm-hmm. Catastrophic for the region. You know, what is it that he's telling Americans? We ought to learn something from this trip, too. They're not just talking to Cheney. Mm-hmm. That this could be a catastrophe for the region. And if that is in any way within the ballpark of accurate prophecy, what does that mean for the war on terror? What does it mean for the effects of a war on Iraq on the war on terror? Does it mean that the Washington Post ran some months ago an assessment from the Pentagon that said, I think I've mentioned this before, that Saddam has put his weapons caches and his laboratories amidst hospitals and mosques and schools. Can any sane person think that our interests are going to be advanced if we try to bomb those places? What possible risk can outweigh the risk of doing that on Al Jazeera before who knows how many potential recruits to Al Qaeda? I think maybe that's what these governments are also telling him. Look, this could be a catastrophe for us because they're going to turn against us first.
Ned Walker, let me put that to you not as a diplomat now, but as a private citizen. Jack paints a dire picture of what might happen in the event of an invasion of Iraq. On the other hand, we're reading in Foreign Affairs magazine this month the description of Saddam possibly going back into the oil fields, but this time with nuclear weapons and saying, try and kick me out this time and I'm going to nuke somebody. Where do you think the real, more serious threat lies here?
I don't think he has nuclear capability. The evidence that I've seen in the past, and I don't think it's changed much, would indicate he's still some distance from that kind of capability.
But, so might this be a catastrophe, as the folks in Jordan are telling Dick Cheney?
Well, it could be. And And that's why you've got to be looking at a very careful plan and one that is considerably more considered, if you will, than we currently have, or at least is apparent. Also, I don't think that anybody has really begun to think about what is Congress going to say? What are the American people going to say if it becomes clear that serious American casualties could result? I mean, everybody's gotten used to the war from the air. This will not be a war from the air. You cannot defeat Saddam Hussein in Baghdad. We've tried.
People are talking about an invasion, a force of 200,000, 300,000
Right.
And
U.S. soldiers. They're also thinking about 1990 when we were facing reservists in another country, not in Iraq itself. Now you're going to be facing crack troops around Baghdad, dug in with a lot of support structure. Not everybody in Baghdad is ready to throw up their hands and join our forces.
Christopher is on the line. Welcome, Christopher. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
It seems to me that there's a parallel a bit between the Arab world and what we saw in the former Yugoslavia.
How so?
We were involved militarily in the region, and there was a lot of debate and discussion about the fact that the Europeans weren't signing up for and taking enough action or responsibility early on in that conflict, and yet it was in their backyard, so to speak.
So you're saying sign Saudi Arabia and Jordan up to fight Iraq?
Well, no, I'm saying maybe the U.S. takes action in Iraq, and shouldn't that, in fact, then be a way to encourage or, in fact, force a hand of the rest of the Arab world to sign up for taking some responsibility for doing something about Saddam Hussein, the biggest threat in their own backyard, and, in fact, perhaps make them take a more active and interventionist role at large in the Middle East, whereas up until now it seems they have been quite recalcitrant.
Let's put that to Ned Walker.
Yeah, the problem is that a lot of people don't see Saddam Hussein as that great threat. They see him as sharply reduced in his capabilities because of all the sanctions that have been put in place. We've talked about how the sanctions have worked so well. We've had military analysts and our own generals saying that he's got a fraction of his capabilities as he had before. They don't see him as poised to attack their countries. They have no credible evidence that they've seen that he has anything other than chemical weapons, which he's had all along. What's so different about today that triggers this? That's what the attitude is out there. And as long as the United States is sitting in the region as strong as it is, they don't feel that they're threatened.
So do you think this is a misguided effort yourself, Ned Walker? You've been ambassador in three big countries out there. You've been in posts all over the region.
No, I don't think it's a misguided effort because I think the long-term danger is very critical. The question is really one of timing. We're going to have to deal with this guy at some point. But my basic feeling is that it's got to be done on the basis of solid planning, on a very clear idea of where you're going, how you're going to get there, and with the support of the countries in the region. If that takes 6 months or a year or 2 years to prepare, I think we have that time.
60% of Americans, or 70% more than that, say they're ready to go in now. Does that make a difference in the Bush calculation?
They are ready to go in now. And then when you take 300 casualties, how long is that support going to last? And if the bodies start coming in day after day, you don't take risks with your own citizens that way, unless you absolutely have to.
People discount that now because the same warnings were raised before Afghanistan, and of course the march to Kabul was quick and relatively painless.
The march to Kabul did not face the Republican Guard, did not face entrenched people around a city which has defenses dug in all over, and which has even separate structures, not just the military structures, but the Ba'ath Party structures, who have been trained to house fighting in time. I'm not saying that the place won't collapse if we make a tough effort. Great if it does, then that's so much the better. But you can't plan a military operation on that basis, and any responsible general is going to be concerned about the lives of his men.
Any chance it will fall down just on the basis of all this talk swirling around it, that the regime will implode?
No chance. Saddam Hussein is much too tough for that and has had too many years of intimidating his people. They aren't going to do that when their families are at stake.
And their families are at stake in that
Obviously,
regime.
Very much so.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with former U.S. Ambassador to Israel, Egypt, and the United Arab Emirates, Ned Walker, currently president of the Middle East Institute in Washington. The question is, what should we learn from the big NOs that Dick Cheney brought home from his tour, is bringing home from his tour of the Middle East? If Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Jordan say no, do you say yes anyway? What should we hear in the resistance from Middle East capitals? Should the U.S. take heed, or should it, can it, just ignore it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this evening about Vice President Dick Cheney's just concluding tour of the Middle East. He went out to test the waters on readiness for an invasion of Iraq. He got a big no from every capital he visited, but we're looking at the nuances of that tonight with former U.S. Ambassador to Israel, Egypt, and the United Arab Emirates, Ned Walker, currently president of the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C. Do Arab leaders know something Washington doesn't about the meaning of war with Iraq, or are they just afraid to take on Saddam? You can join the conversation at 423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255. Nasser is on the line. Welcome, Nasser. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I just want to echo the statement that was made regarding the impact on the, I think it's going to be a catastrophic for the region, for the people of the Middle East, as well as for the relationship.
Why so, Nasser? Why a catastrophe?
A catastrophe because I think people are more educated right now because of the free media that right now that exists there, and people will not take it as, you know, they will not take it as fighting terrorism. They will take it as just devastating the infrastructure of a country, a strong Arabic country in the Middle East. And that's what's been happening for the past 11 years. We could have taken Saddam Hussein in 11 years ago or 10 years ago, but why destroy a whole nation in order for us to get him out? And if we are going after a dictatorship, why not just start with Saudi Arabia and then take it to Sharon and after that, get rid of Mubarak.
So, Nasser, you want all the dictators to come down. Let's stick with Iraq for a moment. What about the concern, Nasser, that there are weapons of mass destruction being developed in Iraq? This is a country that's already invaded an Arab neighbor. Doesn't all that give pause to the Arab populations of neighboring countries?
Absolutely, it does. But let me actually comment on that. I don't think Iraq right now has weapons of mass destruction. I think with what we've done to them through the air bombardment, as well as, you know, the inspectors being there for the past 7 or 8 years, I don't think Iraq has the capability that it had in 1990.
Mm-hmm. Nasser, we've got your point, and I want to turn it to Ambassador Ned Walker. Ned Walker, two points, I guess, there really to come away with. First of all, I guess, is this last one. And you mentioned it earlier, you say Iraq doesn't have nuclear weapons, but there seems to be a consensus that there's enough of a nub or of the base materials for weapons of mass destruction, either nuclear, chemical, or biological, that given enough time, Saddam Hussein can and would come up with them. So first of all, do you see that as a threat and how near a threat? And secondly, to Nasser's bigger point, can this war be carried off without some kind of terrible alienation of the region that will breed more terror in the years ahead?
You know, on the first one, look, he's had chemical weapons all along. He's used them before. Mm-hmm. There's no reason to believe he still doesn't have that capability, and I assume he still does. He was working on biological weapons at the time of the Gulf War. We were very concerned that he would use them during the Gulf War. So if he has succeeded in developing the technology for weaponizing bacteriological weapons, then no doubt he could quickly mount such weapons.
And we've now seen these delivered to Manhattan, to Washington, D.C., which has raised, obviously, the level of concern.
Well, there is a deep concern that this kind of regime would use such weapons in terror tactics, not delivered directly by a state, but delivered indirectly through terrorist operations. On the nuclear side, we were surprised by how far he had gone, actually, in the initial inspections and so on. So this is not a threat to take lightly. It's not necessarily a threat that affects us directly in the next year or two. But we have to take it seriously. Now, as far as the alienation
opinion
and the public opinion, part of it will have to do with what follows. And if there is a rosy scenario, that things go well, that there's a replacement regime, which is democratic or at a minimum is willing to accept the rules of international behavior and becomes a positive player in the Arab world and in OPEC and in the United Nations, then I think that any alienation that takes place will quickly disappear. It'll particularly disappear if, in the meantime, we've been able to act positively on the Palestinian-Israeli issue, which is what really tends to alienate the people in the region. And the second point is that it also depends on whether we are actually getting rid of Saddam Hussein or whether we're still just affecting the people. And part of the problem with the sanctions regime was it affected the people, not Saddam Hussein, and that's what people are objecting to.
So there's the rosy scenario. And to Washington's credit, the Gulf War came out in a fairly rosy scenario, and so to date has the Afghan intervention. But, of course, there could be an ugly scenario here. Nasser also says, hey, if you want to go after dictators, go after Saudi Arabia, go after Ariel Sharon. I don't know how – I mean, that's a democratically elected leader, but these are Nasser's words, not mine. Could an invasion of Iraq, if things didn't go well, somehow be the spark that pulled this region apart? And what are the dimensions of that fear? What might that look like?
Yeah, I think there are real problems. If you had a failed effort, for example, and Saddam Hussein prevailed, it would destroy the credibility of the United States, not only in the region, but in a much broader sense. This would be an effort the United States could not afford to lose. And if you led to a fragmentation and a breakup of Iraq and you didn't have a very secure follow-up plan and a secure follow-up government, that could easily be exported to other parts of the region, Turkey, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Jordan for sure, could all be seriously affected by dissolution of Iraq and the disintegration of the political structure
there. Is that a threat that neighboring countries take seriously? The dissolution that would leak into their own borders.
Absolutely. They take it very seriously. The Kuwaitis and the Saudis have nightmares about a Shiite regime on their border, which was hostile to their way of life and to their countries, the Jordanians, which are dependent on Iraq for their economy, would face enormous hardship if this was cut off as a source of economic trade. The stakes are very high for these countries, which is why they're so concerned.
Alan is on the line. Welcome, Alan. You're on the air.
Yes, Tom, Ned. How are you?
Fine. Well,
my comment is that there's a reason why they all said no, and the reason is the same reason why we were told not to invade Baghdad in 1991. And that reason is that if Iraq were taken over and a democratic regime were installed or formed, it would be a domino theory of democracy that would spread to all the countries immediately. Saudi Arabia, King Fahd would be gone, Hussein and Jordan. All these governments would be over and done with, and you'd have a radical governments from the street running the show. So democracy in the Middle East will not work for these governments.
See this as an anti-democratic no from non-democratic neighbors of Iraq, Alan.
Absolutely.
But of course, Alan,
all these governments.
But Alan, you know, the U.S. does not necessarily have a history of installing necessarily democratic rulers when it goes into countries.
Well, what about Afghanistan? There's your patent, your template for what's supposed to happen here in Iraq. That's not going to work. From Western style democracy, does not work. Look at Algeria. If you want Algeria to exist in all of these countries and have 17 million Osama bin Ladens running the show in Saudi Arabia rather than King Fahd, establish democracy in Iraq, and that will follow.
Alan, it's a very interesting observation. Ned Walker, we've seen you on the record on this front. You've always counseled, or at least recently have counseled, that democracy is a very delicate tool. You've said if you try to impose democracy without the basic civil society that supports it, you get yourself into serious problems. What about Alan's notion that if the U.S. goes in and brings democracy to Iraq, that in itself would be a destabilizing development in the Middle East?
Well, I think it depends partly on the democracy you bring. If you try to bring in or impose a democracy, as they did in Algeria from the top, without the basic structures and the education of the people, I think it's doomed to failure.
But this would be from the top. This would be as a result of a conquest.
And that's why I'm not sure that you're going to get that kind of an immediate movement towards democracy. I'm not sure that the countries in the region are opposed simply because they're afraid that this would be a threat in terms of democracy. What's happening in the region is a gradual movement in that direction anyway. You've got movement towards democratic type of governance in Kuwait, some movement in Bahrain, also in Qatar, and in Oman. Each of these in its own way is moving away from dictatorial or autocratic regimes towards regimes which have a broader representation. These alone are the examples that places like Saudi Arabia have to be concerned about.
Mm-hmm. Patricia's on the line. Welcome, Patricia. You're on the air.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I have a rather cynical attitude toward this thing. I think it's going to spell the downfall of the United States.
Why so, Patricia?
We are we're more or less settled in Afghanistan. It's a wonderful place to be, power-wise. And if we continue this fight, which I'm sure that President Bush hopes will continue, we will be in a power of dominion, and also we'll be taking over the oil in those areas. And the defense that would have to be built up in order to conquer these countries is going to add to Bush's popularity economically and politically among certain groups.
All right, Patricia, I think we've got your view, and granted, it is a very cynical one, but these are times where the whole range of views is open to being heard. Ned Walker, what do you think about this very skeptical view of U.S. or the Bush administration's interests in this campaign?
Well, the United States has historically seldom stayed in any place. It's one of the distinctions that we have. We're a great power, unlike the British and the French and the Dutch and the others that went into other countries. In fact, one could say that we run away from these problems too quickly, as we did after the First World War, as we did in the first case in Afghanistan. We left very quickly. So I'm not too worried about that, and I think our democracy is a great barrier to that kind.
And yet, U.S. forces are still in Saudi Arabia 10 years after the Gulf War. Is Patricia onto something here that the U.S. might seek a larger long-term military presence around critical energy supplies in the region?
No, I think that the U.S. presence in Saudi Arabia is generated by the desires of countries in the region to sustain American defense in the face of overwhelming full power which they face in places like Iraq and Iran. So it's not as if we're imposing our position there. They can say goodbye tomorrow and we'll be gone. They haven't said that.
And Jack Beatty, how are you reading U.S. motives in this buildup?
Here I am. How am I reading U.S. motives? Well, I'm just very afraid. I think there's been a collapse of internal opposition here. The Democrats won't apparently are not going to resist a move on Iraq, and then the public is lumping it into the war on terror, not seeing that these are different dynamics entirely. You know, in the 60s, Senator Fulbright wrote a book called The Arrogance of Power. And he talked about how nations that possess great power succumb to a kind of derangement. They think that they can shape reality to meet their purposes, and they lose touch with what real possibilities and real threats are. And I just hope that President Bush is able to really listen to his father, who has repeatedly said that the reasons he gave for not invading Baghdad in 1991 are still pretty good today, and that we managed to contain the evil Soviet Empire, and we can contain the evil Saddam Hussein.
How about it, Ambassador Walker? Is this the derangement of power or a cold-eyed assessment of the Iraqi threat and the odds of successfully addressing it?
Well, it's certainly not a derangement of power yet, and you've got a pretty solid group of people that are advising the president. There are certainly those among them who have an ideological approach, as somebody said previously. And I'm suspicious of ideological approaches to issues of diplomacy and military enterprise. But so far as I've seen, the administration has been very careful in the way it's pursued its objectives. It hasn't followed its language all the time. And so I'm hopeful for the future.
We've just got a minute left. What do you think Americans should look for as a sign that we're getting close to the actual event, if indeed it's going to finally happen?
Given our military and the way we work, watch the troops. If the troops start funneling into places like Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and so on, if we start getting a buildup of armor that could take on an army like the Republican Guard, then you know we're getting pretty close.
And what are you saying in your column that runs in Al Hayat, the Arab language newspaper?
Well, I'm trying to explain that some of the language that you hear coming out of a number of commentators are not necessarily the President of the United States or his administration, that there's a lot more out there which is frightening in some of the expressions, and that people ought to take the President based on his actions, not on his words all the time.
Ned Walker, President of the Middle East Institute, thanks very much for being with us tonight. Listeners, we want to hear from you. Send your emails to onpoint@wbur.org. Jack, thanks very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is